Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast featuring the Crop Doctors.
Good morning from the Crop Doctors Podcast studio. With Tom and I today, Steve Martin. Steve needs no introduction. Why'd you laugh?
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Steve is back on the payroll, at least the Stoneville payroll, and we'll let him tell y'all what all he's been doing in the meantime. Tom and I decided we're going to call him the new Brian Mills, because I think we called Brian Mills the new Larry Faulkner. Larry was gone before we were doing podcasts, wasn't he?
I think that's right. He may have been here at the very beginning ones that you did via iPad in Bobby's office or your office.
It would be worth our time to call Larry and do a podcast with Larry.
He's still working a little bit, so he'd do that.
That would be
from somewhere in the backwoods of Maine.
I was called the new Fred Cook about 20-something years ago. So,
for those of you that know Brian, Brian's still on the payroll, too. He has moved to campus and is teaching some classes and different stuff. Jeff Gore was fortunate enough to have an ag economist looking for a job.
I'm glad they was open.
We just kind of did a trade.
Steve, y'all moved back to the greater Bolivar County area. So my question for you is, and I debated
this
on.
This was coming. This is
a legit question. Is it worse to pack up all of your stuff and move across the state, or would it be worse to move next door?
Across the state, without a doubt.
You ever moved next door?
I've moved twice in the same town before, where we built a house, and I was living. I don't think I'll ever be through moving.
Well, see, I said the same thing about moving next door. Man, it took us months to get all that stuff moved, 200 yards.
Well, if you didn't have a time frame, you didn't have to get out. I could see that being a trouble. But, man, you know, there's only so much stuff you can haul. And my wife had bought some new clothes, and they were in a bag, the way this ended up on this part of the trip. And she was riding with me. She, you know, something's flopping back there. I said, it's just those bags blowing in the wind. All those new clothes are somewhere between here and Stark, Vegas, Mississippi.
That's awesome.
I had put something in there with a little weight. I had some new Merrells, and I got to Marigold with one of those Merrells. But
nothing worse than an odd shoe.
I didn't complain about that after she lost her clothes, though.
Wow.
There's nothing good about it. It's horrible. You know, you pack stuff up, and then you get a little bit of room left in a box and think, well, let's fill that box on up, and then you can't find whatever that little something else was because you stuck it in the top of a box full of dishes or something.
My mother and I will still get into an argument about a box of things that came out of their house, and I have to think a minute. I bet those came out of our house in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and we're moving to Naperville. And she swears that I lost the box, and I swear that the movers lost it. And she's like, nah, you just never brought that home. I'm like, no, it was down here on this shelf right here. Your movers boxed it up and lost it. And we will still go back and forth every once in a while. And that was a lot of years ago.
Do you still have boxes at your house that you hadn't unpacked from when you moved in, however many years ago?
Yes.
No, I mean, that's a thing, right?
Yes. And then the other problem has been, as my parents have moved around since I had become an adult and moved here, they will occasionally bring something else. And Tracy just hangs her head. Stop bringing me stuff. If I haven't needed it since high school and it was still in your house.
It's yours.
That's exactly right. It's now yours. I don't want it. I don't want to see it. I don't want to know it exists because I haven't called on the phone and said, hey, Mom, do you remember that box of such and such and such and such? I mean, get rid of it.
It's just a memory, right?
We have all of Tracy's teaching stuff in the attic still. That got moved into the house in Cleveland straight to the attic. So that stuff's been in the attic for 17 years.
I told Tom about this yesterday. So my aunt and uncle moved in my grandparents' house. So they had their stuff, but then my grandparents' stuff was still in there. So they had to make room for what they wanted to keep and then decide what they wanted to keep that was already in there. That was like years-long process.
You know, the other thing you really don't think about, especially when you move hour or 2 hours or something away, is tools. You know, you need something to put something up where you're moving to. You also need it back over there to take something apart.
Take it apart.
Aggravating.
You'd think that you'd become a professional when you get into your adult life and you move a few times, but you always forget those little things like that.
I hate it. It's terrible. On the off chance that somebody is not familiar with your illustrious background, why don't you give folks the highlights of the Steve Martin career?
I don't know if there's any highlights, but, you know, I was later getting into this academic life than most people. You know, I worked about 12 or 13 years after my bachelor's before I started my PhD. But came here as an ag economist, did that for several years, and moved to administration here and at Verona and then on main campus. Now I'm glad to be back in the Delta and back to what I quit industry for to go back and get into academia and do ag econ work.
Steve was here when both Tom and I came, and then I guess we worked for Steve for, what was that, 4 years or five?
Probably.
Before he moved to Verona. And then I guess we worked for you for a little bit when you
came back as an interim and COVID hit, and that was about a 2.5-year interim, yeah. So that's good, though. That's good times.
So I guess technically we have worked for Steve at Stoneville longer than we have anywhere else, anybody else, if you count his two runs at that.
Yes, I think that's right.
I think that's right, too. I'm
trying to remember.
Don't hold any of that against me.
No, we don't. It's really nice to have you back.
If I can just figure out what I'm supposed to do, you know.
Don't pull that shroud back, Steve. You'll make people think that.
I've been working on some stuff that I know how to do the last 2 or 3 days, and I know how to do it. And it's like, I can't remember exactly how to do that. But anyway, it's coming. It's coming.
As long as you don't stand in one place very long, people don't actually figure out that you don't know what you're doing. Just keep moving.
Well, an economist, I mean, y'all have this knack of knowing how to do some things in software programs like Excel that some of the rest of us have absolutely positively never seen before. Larry was like a wizard with some things in there. I was like, wow, I didn't know software would do that.
Yeah, Larry's very good. Kurt Lacey, who was here as a regional coordinator for a while, and Kurt's really good at it too.
We have high expectations for you then, because we're going to have to rely on you to show us how to do some of those background things in Excel, because I don't remember. Larry could do pivot tables, like standing on his head. All right, Steve, so you've come back into your new role as an ag economist. Why don't you tell listeners exactly what that role really encompasses for people that may be interested in contacting you for specific information?
Experiment stations all over the country and with our land grant systems. And Stoneville's one of the few, really, and it depends on the state a little bit, has a long history of having ag econ here at this location. At one time, ERS had a person here, as well as what used to be referred to as the state economist, which was the one that worked for Mississippi State. And so at times there's been two here. Several years ago, ERS moved all their staff to Washington, so the person who was with Mississippi State was the only economist here. And that's been here for several different reasons. Stakeholders want to know the value of either some new technology is really what a lot of the history of ag econ here at Stoneville's been is. If we've got go back a few years, this sounds kind of really old now, but, you know, Roundup Ready, does it pay to pay extra for this seed? Again, that's kind of common sense today, you know, or maybe you don't even have a choice, I guess would be a better way to put it. But at one time, you know, that was an option. So things like that in today's era, some irrigation savings probably, precision ag and where the AI tied to that and whatever that is coming forward, things like that. So the value of new technologies is really a more precise way to say it rather than just cost of production of field crops, really, is what I've always... We have a catfish unit here, and I have a really good economist over there, Ganesh. The role I'm in has always been primarily related to row crop agriculture. It's an extension appointment, so we'll do some work with some of our agents and develop some stuff, hopefully, for them that'll assist them. But that's kind of that's very broad, but that's the things we do. I had somebody come by the office yesterday looking for some cost of production on different tillage. Where right now be tillage and planting, you know, because they were thinking of hiring that done or what to pay. And it all depends on if you're in the business of doing that, like a custom harvester, or if you're just trying to help your neighbor out.
We've had Brian and Will Maples in multiple times and talked about the budgets that y'all's department generates every year. Give us some history on that, because you naturally know more about how that's evolved over time than those younger guys do. But, I mean, to me, that's one of the very unique publications that Mississippi State Extension puts out every year. I don't know that they don't, but I feel like that's one of the leading budget publications, your farm budget publications, at least in the Mid-South.
It is. A lot of people in Mississippi just think, you know, it's natural that that happens every year, but it's really unique in Mississippi that that's done to that extent every year. The budget generator, the software that does that, and Brian and them are pretty close to having that updated, where it's a little more user-friendly. It's actually the one that we've been using since before I was ever in that ag econ role, so it's old. But the level of detail it puts into it is unique. Some former research professors in the department actually developed that software. And so several of our bordering states, you know, Louisiana and Arkansas especially, and even some at Texas A&M, have used that for budgets there. But we've done that every year for many years, and I could even tell you how far back it goes, but it would be at least into the 90s and maybe the 80s. And once you get that built and you have a kind of a database there, it's still a lot of work, but you can kind of replicate that. One part of that, not inconsequential, is gathering the data every year to put in there of all those inputs. So you have, you know, all those prices. We've been chastised for not getting them out early enough in the fall, because as soon as people are through harvesting, they want to know what it's looking like for next year. Well, then something changes, especially in fuel. And a lot of times it affects fertilizer prices as well, or commodity prices change. So they're not ever going to probably be accurate for any individual, but they're kind of an average across a broader scale of individuals. And that's the way you got to look at them, as a guide. I think with what Brian and them are working on the new version and new software, that'll be very user-friendly, where people can go in there and pull from a very large data set and customize that for any individual operation or and play with it, you know, do some kind of what-if analysis, what if I change this or change that. You could kind of do that anyway, but it was a lot more trouble than it should have been.
Well, what I see when I look at it and our contribution to it is making sure our parts of the inputs are up to date every year. I think the way we've approached it, and maybe the way that entire those documents for the different crops are approached, is kind of worst case scenario. You could add every possible thing in there, big tillage, big herbicide inputs, fertilizer inputs, fungicide inputs, and you could basically be upside down in a hurry. But I think that's useful, because you can see what the worst possible case is and then scale it back to the inputs that you're actually using. And I think in a conversation with the lending agency that's very helpful.
Yeah. If you're using that to take to your banker, you want to make sure you've got enough to get enough money to plant a crop. Sometimes, and this is one of those years when I've heard comments different places, not necessarily Ag Econ, going to be a little tight this year, you know, on margins. You know, it's tight every year. Some years look better than others, but it's so thin in a row crop agriculture for just a small something to go wrong, and it can turn you upside down. So it's tighter this year than normal, but it's always there.
They're nice from the standpoint that you can a la carte so much of that. Right. You don't have to do all that, because sometimes I get nervous about what that says. If we put that fungicide on there, are we suggesting that's what you should do? And I think you can cross any of those inputs out based on your specific operation, the history of what you've done, and then even just history of specific fields. And in, I think some cases that probably is a little bit more difficult to do than what my little mind can wrap around.
And I think the fact that you do mix and match, that's the beauty of it.
Absolutely, especially since you don't know what's going to happen between now and June and July. And if commodity price is factored into that, commodity price would be factored into it, then if that changes dramatically and say you haven't booked all of your crop, then you can plug and play some of that as well, too.
And if you've budgeted for it up front, at least it's available.
Yeah, I heard Jeff say yesterday, talking about insecticide applications, that usually one of the first questions he gets asked is how much does it cost? And I didn't think about the fact that a lot of insecticide applications are so much later than my stuff. There's just less money left by that point to make those decisions. So price is higher up on the pecking order for that very reason. What other specific projects you thinking about working on, Steve?
Well,
I know you got a long history with rice.
Yeah, well, you live in Bolivar County, you know, you better do a little rice work. They might put you on the outskirts there. We were probably going to look, one of the first things we're going to do is something that you and I and Hunter talked about a few months ago, and look at some of the milling values of some of the rice varieties based on milling grade and yield. I don't know, I talked to Jeff and Don a little bit yesterday about some border economics on some previous work that they had done on some of the borders and relating that to some of the boundaries that are being placed because of endangered species and stuff like that, and see if we can tie something in there to show what that's costing producers to some of these regulations we're constantly dealing with. So work on some of that. That's two quick projects. Got asked to be on a couple of grad student projects. One's a corn, one's a soybean project. Some of the software I've been playing with this morning, I got a long ways to go on that, is some impact. It's called Implan. It's a software that looks at economic impact of different things, probably more used in industry than in ag, but it's used a lot in ag as well.
Well, I was just thinking how much that has all changed just over your short career. Keeping up with the software is not such an easy thing to do.
You're exactly right. The good thing about it, though, is it is so much more user-friendly. If you've never opened it up to, if you think back when SAS was DOS-based, really, I mean, I remember when it became Windows, and you had manuals about 6 inches high to try to figure out how to use SAS, and now everything's in some type of help session, video, YouTube. I may find out I wish I was back in class trying to learn it before it's over with, but on the front end, it looks a little easier. So that, and then, of course, in this part of the state and in the region, things related to farm policy are always on the forefront of producers' minds, whether that's an actual farm bill that ties to the crop or whether that's outside things that indirectly affect you. So
you piqued my curiosity on when you mentioned Jeff and Don and the border stuff, the economics of that, because there's a lot of herbicide aspects to that as well. We need to have a conversation about that sometime. I think we've had, I don't know, Tom, two or three episodes about the Endangered Species Act, and, you know, as recently as, I guess, when
in December.
Stanley and Larry Steckel were on with us. We released that sometime in February, but I think that's a big pivot point for how we're going to operate in the near future. There's a lot of stuff being done in the background and in particular around here trying to prepare for some of those changes to come. You start taking land out of production for a border and then try to account for that in your whole farm yield, and it just doesn't add up real well.
Tie that with, I was talking with Gene Merkel yesterday. It runs our pesticide education program. And unrelated to what we're doing a podcast on today, but related to what we're talking about right now, between worker protection, the rules coming down with farm labor, and the regulations, it's just, I said it was tight. Everything's making it tight. You know?
And Jason and I always talk about you could quit your day job and just read to keep up on that type of stuff because it's big documents. It's not small stuff. And it's difficult to wade through. And some of the ones they've sent to us on the pathology side, I was like, what font's that in? I can't see anything that small anymore. And I certainly don't want to print it off. And that's the overwhelming part some days, I think, at least from where I sit on things, because we're kind of down the pike, the pathology level for the fungicides and all the rest of that. So it's interesting to see what's going on with the herbicide group and the entomologists before it is when they get to us. And then it could get much more interesting than what it has been the last few months.
Well, we're supposed to have some idea by the end of the year for all of them and whether that actually happens or not. You know, the herbicide strategy has been pushed back, the proposed herbicide strategy. They're going to revise that. The rodenticide strategy has been proposed. The insecticide one has a date that it's supposed to be released sometime in the next few months. And then y'all's, I think, is sometime late summer into the fall. It's coming fast. I talked about it some in meetings this winter, but I'm sure in years to come, that's going to be a big talking point for those of us that deal with it. Well, Steve, man, we appreciate it. Let you get back to fooling with your software.
Thank you.
And you don't have to drive back to Starkville.
So. I don't. I got to carry a printer back. You know, my printer didn't make the trip. It's almost as old as me, but it's worked good. But
we got people to do that. We can send it. We can send it by somebody if we need to. Well, man, we're happy you're back. I couldn't be happier.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Known you for a long time and always enjoyed working with you and working for you.
Thank you.
Yep, same goes for me.
The Mississippi Crop Situation Podcast is a production of Mississippi State University Extension.